There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Joining me in the studio this afternoon, I've got Chastity O'Connell. She's mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, here with a sympathetic ear and some wisdom. Good afternoon, Chastity.
Good afternoon, Helen.
Lovely to have you. And I think this is a really interesting and important topic because mental health is obviously at the forefront of so many stories at the moment, for very, very good reason. It's something we're talking about more, something we're learning about more. And hopefully we're breaking down some barriers around the issue of mental health and good mental health, mm-hmm. you know, looking after ourselves in the sense that we have a sore throat, we go to the doctor, we break our leg, we go see an ortho. When it comes to mental health, there seems to be a barrier there about reaching out and getting that help. So we'll be talking about that later in the show, but I really want to pick your brains on a few topics first.
Okay.
Are you a sports fan?
You know, I am not as much of a sports fan. However, anytime the University of Michigan is playing football, I am a diehard sports fan. So I guess I'm a temporary sports fan. When it matters, then I'm well and truly into it. But if not, then I love observing by the sidelines. So I love basketball. I do love watching basketball, though.
So I think that's quite normal. If you have your team, then you're passionate about your team. And mm-hmm. when it comes to other sports and other teams, then it, you know, perhaps not so interested. Obviously, we are in the middle of World Cup fever. Mm. And there's been some really interesting and also some very disturbing statistics that have come out around sports, around winning and losing, and people's reactions to that as well. One of the most disturbing that has come out is that there's a 38% increase in domestic violence when England, the team, loses. Horrendous to hear. What's interesting is also there's an increase of 26% of domestic abuse when England actually wins. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're going to be talking about perhaps linked alcohol when people are out watching that match. But I want to ask you about the psychology of sport. Mm-hmm. As a mental health counsellor, as someone who's done papers and studied people and behaviour, what do you think it is about sport that people just gravitate towards and get so passionate about?
Sure. Well, fundamentally with a sports team, or fundamentally, you know, human beings are social beings and we thrive, we survive when we feel connected mm-hmm. with others. When we, you know, there's this basic psychological need toward connection, toward relating to other people, you know, having that sense of belongingness. And, you know, of course, that can come in many forms. That can come from your family, your last name, your tribe, your community, religious identification, and also sports identification. Mm-hmm. So the idea, you know, you can remove the word sport and, you know, put community there. And it's essentially, we're talking about the same principles. There's an idea that this is something that you want to belong to in this community. You derive benefit. Going to sporting events in and of themselves are a way to maintain and facilitate that sense of connection with the team. But it's also, it's very social. If you talk to people who go to social events, one of the most interesting things that they talk about is how connected they feel with the people that they're sitting around, even though it's a bunch of strangers. Mm-hmm. And you may have found this yourself, or I certainly have, going to football games while I was in uni.
Oh, that, for sure. And it's my grandfather was a massive, I'm going to say football, but soccer for some people, like you, Chastity. huge football fan, and that was his tribe. And as you say, in terms of the social, going to the Newcastle United home games punctuated his life. Mm-hmm. And that's where you could say an event, and he would tie it to a year where Newcastle did well or didn't do well. And the people that sat around him with his, you know, in his seat, they did become friends. So it, in terms of finding your tribe, that is particularly interesting. We would love to hear from you on this. Do you get upset, depressed, even when your team loses? How does it feel when they win? And how long do those feelings last for? I spoke to Marcus, our tech op guy, and I was like, how do you feel about when your team loses? He's a big basketball fan. He's like, yeah, I feel down for a couple of days. I was like, couple of days. Now, we're obviously not the first ones to talk about this, and New Yorker did a fantastic investigation into the psychology of sports fans. So let's listen to this.
You know, I've been a sports writer for 20 years. But really, I just wanted to understand, you know, what made him tick. Why are people so into sports?
This is how we do it for the dogs!
A super fan is somebody who's heavily invested in a team. Their self-esteem is wrapped up in that team. The clinical psychologists that I talked to don't like fandom being described as addiction. They prefer the word obsession. Christopher Lindemann, he's this great little kid. They live outside Chicago. His dad has season tickets to the Green Bay Packers. It's a huge Packers family. But Christopher, when he was a little boy, became an Eagles fan because he loved birds. Very quickly, which can happen with children, he became hugely invested.
Tom Brady, Tom Brady, Tom.
Why are you so mad at Tom Brady?
One day, a couple years ago, he was watching the Eagles play the Patriots. And as he's done over his career, Tom Brady, the Patriots quarterback, was beating the Eagles.
Don't be so mad at Tom Brady.
I hate him, though.
The person most likely to become a super fan is going to be somebody whose parents were super fans or whose siblings were super fans and who at a very young age were introduced into fandom. I am a super fan of one particular team. I'm a super fan when it comes to the United States men's national soccer team. I construct my life a little bit around games. I put them in the calendar so my wife knows when that game is on, I'm going to be unavailable. What it really comes down to is that we have a natural inclination to group. We are biologically wired that way. Going back hundreds of years, it was smart to be part of a group because that's how you hunted and you survived. But we don't need to group for survival anymore. What do? We group around sports teams. Really, what you're doing as a super fan is bolstering all of these other things, your self-esteem, the group, constructing and reinforcing relationships and other aspects of yourself. Teddy Kervin is just this fantastic guy. He lives in Milwaukee. When he was in college, he would go to Brewers game, Milwaukee Brewers baseball games with his buddies. Well, one day they were in the parking lot drinking away and somebody had a banana costume in their trunk. Teddy put it on. So he goes into the game and he's the rally banana. So he starts dancing. He'd raise his shirt. He'd grab his love handles and shake it and yell, "Rally banana." Teddy is a very normal guy. Like you see him on television shaking his belly and you're like, what is wrong with this human being? Teddy's married. He's got a great job. He has a dog. He has a house. I mean, why is this guy, you know, doing this? There's this idea called optimal distinctiveness theory. And the idea is that we need to fit in and we need to be distinct. Those two lines cross for everybody at a different spot. So if you're Teddy, your distinctiveness is way up here. He wants to fit in, but he also really wants to stand out within the group. If you look at the guy who paints his face or gets custom jerseys and wears them all, oh, interesting, you know, everything that they're doing is sort of them trying to reach this equilibrium of distinctiveness and fitting in. Jim Serra was one of the early Portland Timbers fans. He just started bringing a chainsaw to the games, if you can believe that, and they eventually agreed that he would be the mascot. He would climb this spar pole that was at like the south end of the stadium, 100-something feet high, revving this chainsaw. The sad story about Jim is that his daughter was killed in a car wreck when she was a teenager. She just had a baby, and she was killed. He got the news while he was at the game. He ultimately had to raise her daughter, and this was devastating to him. And he kind of gave up in a certain way and didn't want to be involved in the Timbers anymore and Timber Jim. He just didn't see the point in it. But the group sort of wouldn't let him go, and the team wouldn't let him go. They came to him. They supported him in every way, and they still support him. Jim's first game back after his daughter died, after Hannah died, it was really hard for him. He was crying, he was a mess, and somebody scored a goal, though, and he had to come down and saw the log like he normally did, and then just sort of spontaneously went over to where the Timbers Army sits, and he just started singing, "You Are My Sunshine." The fan group at that time was probably only about 200 people. They knew Jim. Like, they knew the pain he was in, and so they just started singing it back to him. At the 80th minute of every game, they sing "You Are My Sunshine," which was his daughter's favorite song. They honor her and him, in essence, every game. I talked to him about this and I said, you know, does it make you sad? And in some days it does. Some days he goes in the tunnel away from where they're singing. But other days he's there holding up, you know, the scarf with the sunflowers on it that was her favorite flower, and he's singing with him. It was so remarkable how resilient he was, but he was resilient because the Timbers Army, this fan group, helped him get through this hard time and then continued to support him to make sure that he was okay. If you believe that we are sort of a country divided, a country that is finding it harder and harder to reach across the aisle, to open ourselves up to people who are different than we are, then what's left that can bridge those differences? Why do Green Bay Packer fans get together in bars all over the country? Any moderately sized city that you go to has a Packers bar. You're sitting around people who you might see the world completely different than them, but you'll high-five them after a goal is scored. You know, you might hug them after the championship game. You might debate them on message boards in a civil way because you both have a shared love of a team. It's one of the few things in our society that remains that bridges our divides. And in that way, you know, our fandom is really important, even just for a couple hours on Sunday.
Joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, as we talk about obsessive sports fans and those emotions that happen, win or lose. Interesting there, Chastity, to hear that clip from The New Yorker talking about the psychology of sports fans and that sense of belonging, that pack mentality. And I understand that. I get that. Where I struggle is the destructive side. The, if we lose, I'm going to burn my shirt, I'm going to burn a car, I'm going to burn a couch. And this is what we've seen time and time again in the past. And there's a very famous article called Flip Cars, Burning Couches, A Brief History of Destructive Post-Game Celebrations. And I'm making huge assumptions here. But let's say majority of sports fans, such as NFL and kind of, you know, UK Premier League, will be male. Could we assume, could I project that perhaps football sports can be used as a conduit, as a vehicle, as a way of men dealing with their emotions?
It's as a way of dealing. So what's interesting is, I think, distinguishing what dealing means and processing. And so as a way of processing emotions, getting out these negative emotions, that kind of violent behavior or the aggressive behavior that follows.
And as we said, this can be very upsetting and often tragic consequences to that violent behavior. Mm-hmm. As we said earlier, when England team loses, there's a 38% increase in domestic violence reported. And even when they win, a 26% increase, to the point where certain areas in the UK are putting on special dedicated police cars, increasing staff around that area of support for reporting. This is a big deal.
It is. And what I want to, before answering that, is sort of disentangle what that violence is actually comprised of. And so when you're looking at the violence that happens after a sporting event, there's one massive factor that plays a contributing factor, and that's the presence of alcohol. And so whenever we're talking about violence after, you know, intimate partner violence, domestic violence, or even aggressive acts against property and other people, alcohol plays a key role in that. And with alcohol, we also know that it's, you know, people may use it for coping, to help, you know, distract from intense feelings, to mask intense feelings. And so by the very presence of alcohol, one is not actually dealing or coping or facing. They're in fact avoiding. So I would say in those in that context of getting out that aggression, it's really not processing. There's a complex combination of what is alcohol and what that does to our brain, as well as the presence of things like adrenaline and the unique relationship between adrenaline and alcohol, as well as just in general, zooming out outside of sporting events, we know that alcohol plays a role in violent acts in and of itself, regardless of the adrenaline presence of a sporting event, as well as intimate partner violence, homicides, suicides. So this really is important to sort of emphasize there's the role of alcohol in that alcohol doesn't allow for any kind of emotion processing.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, there's another consequence, shall we say, of teams winning, mm-hmm. and that's a baby boom. So it's been reported as a bit of a myth, but there has been some data to back this up, that the winning city of the Super Bowl can generally expect a baby boom 9 months after after that winning score. So there's been an article, obviously, early in the year. The Eagles, so mini Eagles fans are on the way. Baby boom expected in Philly following Super Bowl win. So just saying, it's not always burning couches, shall we say. We've had a text here from Sal on the topic of emotions following sporting events. Sal is saying, this sounds crazy, but my husband falls into what I would consider a depression after his football team loses or even draws. He's irritable, quiet, disinterested for days. I can't understand it at all, and I don't know what to say to make it better. It's honestly affecting our family life, and I'm dreading the season starting again. At least England won their match this week, so he's in a good mood at the moment. Hard, because if, as we said earlier, if you're not a sports fan, you don't have the emotions, you're not as invested, you don't understand the psychology and the tribe and the adrenaline even. What could this lady do to support her husband and also to deal with this as a family?
Well, I think just, you know, reaching out and starting the dialogue, because, you know, in these situations, it sounds like it's Sal with her husband and family, and it can feel very isolating and lonely during those times, and how to manage his reaction to the sporting event. And by, you know, sort of reaching out for support, reaching out for guidance on how to handle this, you can help sort of put yourself in your husband's shoes on one hand. So understanding that, you know, with these sports affiliations, there's a lot that comes with it. You're talking about part of someone's identity, their motivation, you know, their decision to meet with other people, to cheer, to wear the hats, the t-shirts, the things that go along with it, as well as that sense of belonging, that sense of believing. You know, mm-hmm. people have this, hold on to this hope, and hope we know is healing. Hope is a massive factor.
Very interesting, and absolutely, when you think about this, the sheer numbers behind it, the sheer statistics of the number of wins, the number of losses, and the number of draws. If that was to be in any other situation, so analogy I saw earlier was, if you were to order a pizza, and let's say half of the slices were missing and a few more slices had the wrong topping on it, and maybe three slices were just what you wanted. Would you order that pizza again?
Absolutely
not. Probably
not.
But yeah. It's that hope, or the promise of hope, mm-hmm. that can hook people in, and understandably so. And sure. then when you're disappointed, what can happen?
Sure. And when you're disappointed, so when that's gone, and I think there's something that you mentioned earlier about processing of emotions. In sporting events, people take on, they do exhibit different kinds of emotions. And so you might have really, you know, shy, introverted people shouting and letting it all out, or hugging the person next to them. And so there is a behavioral part that is, you know, people that might ordinarily not behave in such a manner are feeling free and uninhibited to behave in a certain way. So getting back to your question about, you know, how do you go forward? So there's part of it is just understanding that this is much more to your husband than it is to you. Mm-hmm. And then there's also looking at how to, you know, have a conversation about, how can we navigate through this? You know, so you need some time. What is that going to look like? Ways to support that. But at the same time, if, you know, hubby is taking this time to process, and people process being upset about different situations in different ways, then this may be the time where, you know, mom starts looking at, you know, different ways that she can help get her needs met while you know, hubby is also going through this difficult time.
I would find this so frustrating. Sure. I truly would. If it was my husband being irritable with my kids, because the sporting team lost, it would take a great deal of patience for me to not scream at his face and say, get it together. You're missing out on time with your kids.
Well, and I'm not saying having a kind of conversation about, okay, I know this is disappointing for you. I know this is upsetting for you, but we still have to live through this. So how can we make this work where you can have that time to process? Because we all get upset about different things where we're like, we just want to be in our own funk. Unfortunately, we have judgments about what is funk worthy and what isn't.
Yes.
And so getting upset about a sporting event for someone who does not have the same enthusiasm toward it can seem very trivial. Mm-hmm. But think about it might be a time to look at, self-reflectively, like, what are the things that upset you that your husband doesn't understand?
Oh, okay, that's a whole other show, Chastity.
Exactly. So what we're talking about essentially is empathy. Mm-hmm. And allowing the other person some grace and some latitude, but still there are expectations, there are roles that need to be fulfilled. And so it's fine. It's, having the conversation about how do we navigate through that.
Okay, I hope that helps. When we come back, we're talking about therapy. Do you need it? You might be surprised. We are talking psychology this afternoon as I'm joined by Chastity O'Connell. She is from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, mental health counsellor, and here to offer some emotional support to anyone in need, as well as her expert insights. Now, we've had you on the show for a while, Chastity, friend of the show, I think it's safe to say. And we always talk about the big topics. We talk about things that are happening behind the headlines. We talk about issues affecting people here in Dubai, internationally. And what I really want to do today is to go back to basics and to help people understand what therapy is, what the different types of therapies available to them, and why it could be beneficial. Because I think for many of us, therapy or counselling has got this feel of being a very much other. It's something that other people would do. I'm sure it's great for them, but maybe not for me. I couldn't justify the cost. I don't know what I would say. I don't know who I should speak to. If I do need help, how do I get it? What are the steps? So this afternoon, I really want to reach out to people who feel like perhaps they do need some emotional support. So how did you get into counselling, Chastity? Let's start with you.
Firstly, I would have to say that I think this is a phenomenal topic to cover because it is demystifying the process. You know, we have clients that come into the clinic, and I'm sure other clinics would share the same sentiments, that just didn't know where to start. Mm-hmm. They just knew that they needed something and not what. So I am delighted to be a part of, especially this, raising that awareness. How did I get into counseling? Well, it's something that I think has always been there. And it was, I had worked in Washington, D.C. for quite a long time and found that I was gravitating more toward working with individuals than I was with the people that I was working with, than I was necessarily the content that I was doing in my role. And so I decided to go back to school.
What was your role?
Pardon?
What was the role you were doing? What were you supposed to be doing when you were talking to people and counseling them on your office time?
I was doing, doing a kind of political analysis, and so very government oriented and looking at international relations. So, and I just found that my focus became less and less on the international relationship between countries and the reality that, just drawing connections and understanding that when people were distressed, they didn't perform as well at work. Mm-hmm. So it was really important in this role to provide a kind of emotional support to people in order to certainly help them feel better about themselves, but it also impacted their work productivity and just becoming more fascinated by that. So I went back to school and pursued a master's in counseling, and also went back again to do clinical psychology as well, and finishing up on that. So what's unique in my situation is that I have experience with the counseling side of the house, which tends to focus more on people that are struggling with temporary sort of problems that are going on. So counseling, there's this supportive role there, whereas clinical psychology in the past has tended to focus more on severe and persistent mental illness. Mm-hmm. But in today's day and age, there's such a massive overlap between the two. So it really is, it's very clear to me, but I could see someone coming in saying, well, what's the difference between a counselor? What's the difference between a psychologist?
Yeah, what's the difference between a psychiatrist and psychologist?
Well, a psychiatrist, great question, is a medical doctor that is specialized in psychiatric disorders.
So they could prescribe?
They can prescribe medications. Okay. A psychologist is a different kind of professional. And depending on where you're from, they can be at a doctoral level or a master's level. And they're there to diagnose, as well as provide treatment, as well as assess. So there's the diagnosis process, sort of understanding what people are suffering with, providing treatment. But then there's also this wide range of assessments, sort of understanding if someone has a kind of neurocognitive challenge, if someone is struggling with, maybe cognitive difficulties and not really understanding what is going on, then they could see a psychologist to try and diagnose what might be the underlying issue. And as part of that, they would undergo some testing.
Okay. So let's say, I'm thinking about getting some therapy. I have had therapy in the past and I very happily talked about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to talk about it again. But I think for a lot of people, it's like, what does that room look like? Am I going to be on a couch? Mm-hmm. Is that, what does it generally be? Is it going to be a clinical environment? Is it going to be more homely? And I guess that differs obviously between clinics and between individuals as well. What's your room like at Human Relations Institute and Clinic? Can you describe it?
Sure. Well, we have a unique arrangement where there's five different treatment rooms and you pick the room that you feel most comfortable in. It feels like a nice lounge. It doesn't feel clinical at all. You might find that some offices are a bit more clinical than others and people may like that, mm-hmm. that formality. But for us, there's comfy chairs, a big couch. You don't have to lay down on it. In fact, most people do not. And, a beautiful view. And just, it feels safe. I think that's the most important, is making sure that whatever sort of therapy room you establish, that people feel safe and comfortable in it.
Mm-hmm. I first went to see somebody when my dad had been diagnosed with cancer. Mm-hmm. And I was far away from home and didn't know what was going on and felt very out of control about things. And I simply got a recommendation from a friend, mm-hmm. and someone to this day that she sees via Skype because she loves her so much. And it was so interesting for me to have that first session because it wasn't covered by insurance, so I was paying. Mm-hmm. And I think we're so used to someone saying to us, "How are you?" And you going, "I'm fine." And that being it. And that's what I found the trap I found myself falling into for the first kind of 10, 20 minutes of having a very pleasant, very superficial conversation, because that's what I was used to doing in terms of having small talk. And whether that was, at work events or socially, you meet somebody, you have a perfectly nice chat. And I just caught myself and thought, I'm paying money to lie to somebody about me being fine. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a trap that probably a lot of people will fall into, is you've taken the step to make an appointment, to go to a clinic, to speak to somebody. You're not there to say that you're fine. Mm. But making yourself vulnerable and having that first open conversation, it can be really, really difficult. And then in subsequent therapy sessions with the same woman, who I still see her kind of maybe two or three times a year, and I always think about her being a bit of an MOT, just missing go, and I'm going to check in with her.
Good for you.
And it's interesting because I always go there with a kind of a topic in mind or something I want to discuss, and it always ends up being something completely different that actually is underpinning everything. Mm-hmm. And then after going to see her a few times, because my dad got sick again and he got sick again, and then life happens and I got engaged and married and pregnant with it very, very, very quickly, and had this huge identity, like, what's going on? I don't know who I am anymore. And I got to the point where I would literally just sit in her chair, and as soon as I sat down in that chair, I would cry, and that was fine, mm-hmm. you know, because I knew I could. Mm-hmm. And I think but that took a little while to feel like you were in a safe space with someone you can talk to. And we'll talk later about the importance of finding mm-hmm. the right personality for that and finding the right help for you. We'd love to hear from you on this topic this afternoon. Have you ever sought therapy? Have you ever thought about it? If you have and haven't actually made that appointment, what's been stopping you? We're also here to address any concerns that you might have about your own mental health, any issues perhaps affecting friends or family. Got Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, with us until 2 o'clock this afternoon. When we come back, your questions. Joined for On the Couch this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, as we really demystify and scratch the surface of therapy, the different types, and really who can benefit from that. We'd love to get your questions on the topic of therapy, but also any concerns that you might have around your own mental health and well-being or that of friends and family. A message here from Donnie saying, I've battled depression and suicidal thoughts since being a teenager. I tried being silent about it for years and that didn't work. My dad tried to beat it out of me and that didn't work. I tried medication and that didn't work. When I went to university, I tried to drink it away and that didn't work. I tried running off to work. I tried to settle down. I threw myself into a really busy job that didn't give me time to think, and that didn't work. I tried to buy myself nice stuff like clothes and cars and house, and that didn't work. I got a dog and that didn't work. I tried to have relationships with entirely unsuitable people, and that didn't work. Finally, age 40, having had to leave 3 jobs, lost 2 partners and my home, I decided I should try talking to a professional about it. And I did. And guess what? It worked. Really powerful message
wow,
there.
Absolutely.
And no name on this one, saying, I'm currently seeing a child bereavement counsellor along with my support group. It is benefiting me greatly. And a question here saying, from Dee, it just says, how can I get my teenage daughter to seek help for what I think is an eating disorder, binging and purging in secret, but I've caught her twice? I've tried to raise the subject gently, but she denies it and is quiet with me for a few days after. Should I take her to the doctor?
And so when we're looking at these kinds of adolescent-related or disordered eating behaviors, it's very, very sensitive. And there's a spectrum of, you know, eating disordered eating, and you know, full-on eating disorders. So sometimes it's something as simple as printing off some pamphlets and leaving them around the house. And just, you know, the fact that mom is gently raising the subject and just continuing to gently raise the subject, and letting your daughter know that you're there for her. And it's when it becomes an issue to really start thinking about it's, I guess the most important thing is if you can be collaborative and have her express the desire to go, that is preferred. At the same time, if there's any risk to her health and well-being, then that is where it is important to, you know, take matters into your hands and start consultation and looking at trying to get her the help that she needs.
Okay, I hope that helps. If you've got any questions, do get in touch, 4001 on the text. You can message us for free using the Buy I Messenger app, and you're always welcome to give us a call as well, 04423 1010. Now, Chastity, we were just talking about why therapy can be so important, and what I want to discuss now is what purpose it serves. I can speak personally in terms of why I have found it useful over the years, and that's to say, as I said earlier, I've been, you know, a couple of times a year for a bit of a mental health MOT, and it wasn't covered by insurance, but honestly I felt like it was money well spent. Even if it was, you know, was worth some sacrifice in other areas, it's, you know, I wouldn't think about spending, you know, 600 dirhams on, you know, brunch for two. Why not spend it on something a little bit more productive, perhaps? But what I think I needed, and what so many people need, is that impartial ear. I think when you're trying to have a conversation with somebody, whether it's related to career or relationship or mental health issues such as depression or anxiety, everybody, whether they realize it or not, listens with some kind of agenda, with some kind of bias, and if they know you well, with some kind of context that might not serve you and kind of what you're looking for. And why I have found counselling or speaking to somebody in a professional capacity so useful is there's no bias there. Is that something that people should be seeking out?
There's, you know, as you mentioned, there's a lot, you know, we mentioned the word therapy, but behind that word, there's a lot.
And therapy gets misused quite a lot now. It's all like, you know, adult colouring book therapy and, you know, it's been kind of desensitized and it's been widespread. So when you think about therapy, what do you associate?
Well, it's interesting. Therapy, I think, you know, you can define it, and people would define it in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, talk therapy, the act of talking with a licensed professional about different problems, challenges, beliefs, thoughts, behaviors that you might be struggling with, emotions that you might be struggling with. At the same time, there's, you know, behind that word, there's a lot of research, training, work that has gone into sort of developing that word. And I think sometimes the word therapy even has a negative connotation for some folks. They're like, they'd rather call it, well, I just need to talk to someone or I maybe some counseling. And so you can call it by many different names. But what's important is that therapy, for safety reasons, you know, needs to take place with a trained and licensed professional. And so behind that training, for example, psychologists in the U.S. go to school for a minimum of 5 years. Usually it takes them 5 to 7 years to complete their doctorates in psychology. And what I'm talking about are clinical psychologists. You can also have psychologists that don't practice psychology, social psychologists, cognitive psychologists. And so it's really important to look for the clinical before, because some are in the research and teaching roles. And so there's the training that's involved. And in that training, in and of itself, is decades upon decades of research on human development. There's decades of research on what therapeutic approaches work, what hasn't worked, what's gone completely wrong in some therapies, what we should avoid, what we can do to facilitate therapy. So behind that word is training, is practice, is certainly a professionalization of how to help people in a way that's going to help them and not hurt them. And I think that's really important. One of the things I think it's important to caution people is that when you are looking for a therapist, training and education is important. Don't be afraid to ask them about their training. Don't be afraid to ask them about what they specialize in. A lot of times, you know, there is specialized training for things like addictions or for trauma or particularly autism. You really need to go to someone who specializes in autism in order to increase your chances of having effective treatment. And also as part of that is evidence as to what works. So there have been hundreds, thousands of clinical trials on different types of treatment approaches that work. And those are the ones we're trained in. So it's really important to help empower people with the kinds of questions they can ask in order to make sure that they're seeing the right person, because there are individuals that may call themselves counselors, that may call themselves advisors, guidance facilitators, and what have you. And oftentimes these are perhaps well-intentioned people, but they may not have the training or the professionalism. There's certain elements related to confidentiality, privacy, doing no harm, and knowing, you need to know what causes harm in order to do no harm. And inadvertently, sometimes people can be harmed by the therapy process, which is unfortunate.
And also a huge amount comes down to chemistry as well. It's got to be a person that you feel you can open up to. I would go as far as to say you probably need to like them as a person and want to open up to them and feel comfortable. And it's okay to find someone who ticks all the boxes when it comes to education and training, but simply not to click with them.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it's feeling empowered to make a choice in those situations. If you're seeing someone and it's like any other medical professional that you would see, if the doctor that you're spending time with, you know, keeps his eyes in his clipboard, barely makes eye contact, and doesn't really listen and take on board what you're trying to say, it's probably advisable to find another doctor. And the same goes for a therapist, particularly when you're dealing with such sensitive content. So you should, at a minimum, and I usually don't use the word should, but I'm going to use it now, feel safe, feel respected, certainly not feel judged. Those are just key, you know, components underlying any kind of therapeutic practice, feeling that someone is being genuine with you. And I'm just using Carl Rogers, who I love. So feeling genuine with you, feeling that you're accepted, and certainly feeling empathy. And so those are key components that go across, no matter what the theoretical orientation is. And what I mean by that, different psychologists will have different approaches. You might have heard of cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavior therapy, but we can talk about that later.
When we come back, we have got your questions answered, and we're also going to be looking at why some people would be resistant to therapy and why they really should have a second thought about that. We are talking about therapy this afternoon, really understanding what it's all about and what you can expect if you make an appointment with a therapist or a counsellor or a psychologist, and really demystifying this very popular and for good reason way of improving ourselves and improving our mental health. Lots of tragic cases in the news at the moment, people sadly just not reaching out and getting the help that they need. We are here on Hand until 2 o'clock this afternoon, and I'm joined by Chastity O'Connell from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. No name asking, I know this sounds awful and I do love my mother, but I'm arranging my holidays back home for the summer, and I've just arranged to go away with my sister and her family for a week. I've just found out that my mum has booked into accommodation nearby and has invited herself along to join us. But neither my sister and I want us to join the two families. Between us, we have 6 children, and my mum is not at all hands-on with them. We'll not have any transport, etc. And her being there completely changes the dynamics of the holiday. I will spend time with her over the summer, but how do I let her know we don't want her to join us during our week away without hurting her feelings? Ouch.
Ouch. I was just thinking the same thing. So there's, looking at this, I think it's something that is going to hit close to home for a number of listeners, particularly as people are making plans to go back home. Mm-hmm. And it's a unique challenge for expats in that when we go back, it is not just us going back to our home countries, it's also our holidays too. And so in thinking about that, this time with your children is precious. This time as a family unit is precious. And it's really important to have that time to regroup and you know, without the pressures and stresses that work and school plays a role in that. So, you know, how do we work with mom? And so it sounds like mom has already booked her accommodation nearby.
It sounds like it.
So my question would be, is it refundable, or are we looking at trying to, we're laughing to keep from crying. Uh-huh. I think we've all been there.
I only can imagine myself in this situation. Yes. And it makes my heart sink.
See, and it's hard. So it's a question of, are we looking at, the question that the listener posed was, how do I let her know I don't want her to join us without her hurting her feelings? And then there's the, it sounds like she's booked in. So what is possible at this point? And one of, I guess, some thoughts to think about going into it is boundaries. And although it's really challenging, it's sometimes acting as if she is not there. I'm not saying ignore, but focusing on what you would do with your family. And again, trying to keep that your time. And so if the decision is there and it's possible for her to talk to her, you know, there, one way to handle it might be to say, mom, you know, it'll be really busy. You know, my other sister is there with her children. I'd really love to spend one-on-one time with you.
That's what I would do.
Alone. So is there any way that we can go somewhere else special? And this way you're you're actually moving toward something rather than trying to damage control, if that makes sense. I don't think that was, maybe I didn't explain.
No, but I know what you mean in terms of flatter her, say, you know, I want it to just be us, we can have some quality time together, et cetera. Flatter, and hope that she doesn't play the, oh, I just want to see the children, card.
But I do think it's important to be genuine in the sense that, so doing some reflection on what is it that is problematic about this situation? Is it that mom went and acted unilaterally without actually consulting? And you know, it might be worthwhile to perhaps talk about that.
That happens a lot here with family in-laws booking flights. Hi, we arrive March 16th. We'll be here for 10 days. We didn't discuss this, but it happens a lot.
Absolutely.
Without consultation. And it's even more intrusive if someone is inviting themselves to stay in your home.
And you might, some situations are, even if they didn't consult, there is an expectation that you have to say yes. So even if they said, you know, we're thinking about coming, it's not a good time. How do you handle that? And so boundaries are something that come up all the time in managing relationships. So I think there's a lot of elements to this, which is mom's booked a house nearby and working with, okay, what is your reaction to that? Is it frustration? Is it anger? Is it disappointment that, you know, you wanted to spend this time with your sister and with her children? You know, there's an element of flattery that's important, but it's also important to try and tap into this empathy and compassion for your mom's situation, but this understanding of what you feel as well, and honoring the fact that mama would have loved if she would talk to me about it first, because this is what we have in mind, and communicating honestly and gently that you would have appreciated a call first or a discussion about it, because I do think there is something to that relationship there.
Yeah, I hope you get this sorted. Otherwise, you won't be playing as many games of Cards Against Humanity as you might have had plans for that trip.
Well, and I think in that trip, it's also important to, you know, go on and do what you plan to do. And if it is riding roller coasters and going to the beach, and that is not suitable for mom, it's not necessarily doing it to alienate mom, but there is that, you know, you can join us for dinner, but we will be doing these things during the day. So having those boundaries in place.
Okay, I really hope that helps, and good luck with whatever you might decide. A gentleman saying, I'm in a huge amount of debt that my wife doesn't know about. I feel like I have nowhere to turn and no way of getting out of this. I've let everybody down. I love her a lot, but think that leaving her would be easier than telling her about what I've done.
Wow. So in this situation, it sounds like there is a lot of despair, which can color a person's ability to see the situation objectively. And what I mean by this is, you know, the idea that leaving her would be easier than telling her about what I've done. And maybe from your perspective of having that despair, that sense of nothing's going to help this situation, that might be your perspective. But your wife's perspective might be, I want to keep this marriage together.
Absolutely.
And if I had known, we could have done something about it together. And so at this point, there's one concern, which is that we know that debt, along with other stress factors, can have a huge impact on the decisions that people make. And so I would strongly encourage you to reach out and get some help, because it is concerning to hear about, you know, thinking that you would leave the marriage rather than come forward with her. So it sounds like there isn't a sense of as much hope as one would like to hear that. So I'd love for you to reach out to someone.
And speaking as a wife, I think most women, and indeed most partners, would just prefer that honesty and transparency. She's not going to like what she's going to hear, and you need to be prepared for some anger and upset perhaps. But ultimately, you know, if you're happy and in love, apart from this debt and this secret that you're keeping, you we'll be able to find a way to kind of hopefully move forward together. Mm-hmm. Lots of texts coming in, and we'll get to as many as we can after this. A message here, indeed, with no name on it. Asking You Chastity. My husband and I have been married for 14 years and we have two children aged 8 and 6. But the last two has seen our intimacy stop completely. I find this really upsetting and it's not spoken about. The only mention of it is that my husband is, quote, not attracted to me and he absolutely will not come to counselling with me. What should I do?
And so when we're thinking about difficulties that happen in the marriage, there's a number of factors to consider. And so here we're talking about intimacy. And I will say, just in our experience at the clinic, that this is a very difficult subject. So I want to certainly, you know, give kudos to the person for bringing this up, because what you're going to say resonates with a lot of people. It's one of when you're looking at Google searches on marriage and intimacy, it's one of the most, when you're looking from a therapeutic perspective, from a psychology perspective, it is an often Googled item.
And male and female. It's a big misconception that it's, you know, male libido is higher than the women's. That's obviously not always the case and certainly is not the case in this situation, which is why perhaps she seems so worried about it.
Absolutely. So I think sometimes when people are in these situations where one person's desire for intimacy is not at the same level as the others, it can feel incredibly isolating and very lonely, and they feel like they're the only person in the entire world. So what I want to say is that you're not. And there's a lot of people that are struggling with this very same issue. And although that may not help your specific situation, it does help in a lot of ways normalize what is an experience that people can work through together. It also sounds like hubby doesn't want to come to counseling. And this is a challenging situation if hubby is unwilling to come to counseling. And so there's a number of options here. And one of them is, you know, potentially going to counseling yourself and finding ways to cope with this lack of intimacy. You know, there's different approaches that look at couples therapy for one. And although it is absolutely way more ideal when both parts of the couple can come to counseling, some of that is just having only one can be, you know, if you're looking at a systemic approach, changing different reactions, looking at different ways to understand how one's perception of the situation and shifting that perception a little bit can change what is the aftermath or impact. So, for example, if the conversation goes something like this, you know, why don't we ever spend time together anymore? You know, hubby says, well, you know, if you nag at me, whenever we do, you tell me all the things that I'm doing wrong. And so I don't want to. And so there's this pulling apart. If we can look at different relationship patterns and ways of navigating those in a different way. And again, the onus is not to put the responsibility on the wife in this case to make all the changes, but there's changes that she's part of as part of the pattern, but then there's also changing her response to that, where she doesn't feel like his withdrawing from intimacy is dragging her down as well. So, you know, whether or not it's, you know, him not being attracted to you is, you know, that's maybe what he's saying. But at the same time, you, through therapy or through working through it, that doesn't have to mean that you're not an attractive person, that you're not attractive to your children, that you don't have attractive qualities. So some of that is just helping strengthen and buttress your own internal sense of self, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right in terms of she can control her own responses to this isolation and physical rejection. And that, of course, is going to have an impact on confidence, self-esteem, and stop initiating things. So in an ideal world, yes, of course, try to get him to go. But as you said, changing the conversation, changing the way you're approaching these discussions might go a long way to help as well. Really hope that helps. From the text line, a question here saying, my 9-year-old daughter is too hyper. She rudely behaves like a teen with me and my wife. She's also an attention seeker. She doesn't like when our attention is towards our twin daughters who are younger than her. Any advice on that, please, Chastity?
Sure. Well, family dynamics are always interesting. And so we're talking about a 9-year-old. I'd love to know the ages of the twin daughters. And certainly when we're looking at children's behavior, we're looking at, in terms of treatment, you're looking at one of two different approaches, whether or not it's parenting strategies on how to use different tools to evoke a different response in children. Mm-hmm. So if a child is tantruming rather than shouting, rather than giving into the tantrum, one tool might be ignoring, depending on the circumstances. So there's parenting that could be one approach. And then there's also sort of a family therapy approach. Because when there are other children in the family, there is certainly this competition for resources and competition. I'm serious. It's like,
especially with, you know, with twins going from 1 to 3 children, that's going to be a big change for everybody to adapt to.
Absolutely. And there is, you know, and we mustn't forget that there is a novel effect with twins. It's like, oh my goodness, twins, two girls. Wow, look at that. So naturally, just by virtue of being something different than what is ordinarily expected, you know, multiple births versus singleton births, there's an attention there. And so, you know, looking at perhaps a family approach to understand, so part of it is understanding when does this behavior happen, how does it happen, and those circumstances. And is it happening at a time when the twins are getting more attention, or is it happening at a time when mom and dad are coming home from work stressed? Is it happening at a time where, you know, she's off playing quietly by herself and, you know, all of a sudden becomes disruptive? So it's really understanding, it's really important to troubleshoot how this behavior happens, to understand what function it's serving. Is it attention-seeking behavior, or are we looking at something else? And sort of a family approach can help understand that. But certainly parenting is one of the first lines of defense with navigating tantruming and a difficult behavior in children.
It's interesting because I always think of tantrums being, you know, kind of toddler related. Do they typically stop, and when does it become behavioral issues?
When do they stop?
I'm asking the 3-year-old, and I really want to know when the tantrum is going to stop.
40?
No, I know. I've been known to tantrum.
So when do tantrums stop? Well, what we also need to understand is that people have different levels of emotional reactivity. Mm-hmm. And you might have someone that, you know, sees something really painful and it's like, oh, that's too bad. And someone that sees the same situation and is in floods of tears. The same thing with anger reactions, fear responses. We all have different levels of emotional reactivity. And so some people are just more sensitive than others. You know, this sort of orchids versus dandelions, not versus, but in between the delicate, fragile, beautiful orchid and that hardy, nuclear resistant dandelion is all sorts of different manifestations of how people respond emotionally. So what do you do with that? That's partially, so knowing the temperament of the individual and also understanding what function it serves. Is it because they've had this intense emotional response and they have no idea to communicate with it, how to communicate it? Is it trying to seek attention? Is it trying to get needs met? Is it a case where there aren't other resources available? Mm-hmm. So the screaming and flailing is a way of, is the only tool that they have. So it's about teaching tools. There's mindfulness, there's breathing exercises, there's other ways of coping. So it really is, so I'm saying a family approach and understanding when and how the behavior happens will give an indication of what function it's serving. And so with your 3-year-old, getting back to that.
I can tell you, Daniel Tiger is helping us. For any parents struggling with tantruming toddlers, Daniel Tiger on Netflix. There are some little kind of songs and rhymes that Daniel sings about. I'm not going to sing it. But if you feel so mad and you want to roar, take a deep breath and count to 4. And my 3-year-old has been known to mutter this to herself between tears. Oh. And it does seem to work.
Beautiful.
So I'm moving away from the Peppa Pig and moving towards Daniel Tiger, which has got some good little life lessons. When I dropped off at nursery this morning, she said, you'll come back. I was like, yeah, of course I'll come back. And there's an episode of Daniel Tiger where the grown-ups go out for dinner and they have a babysitter and they have this little rhyme that kind of goes, grown-ups come back. So every time I leave the house, she's like, you come back, as if I'm going to walk away from my life and never return to the house, which I'm not going to lie, has definitely crossed my mind at times. When we come back, more of your questions. Joined this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic to offer her emotional support and a never-ending wisdom. We've got a question here, simply signed off, miserable of mood on. You don't need to put your name on these messages if you prefer. We know some of the topics are sensitive and private, perhaps, so don't worry about that. Miserable says, advice, please. We're leaving Dubai in 3 weeks and I'm devastated. My husband has a fantastic new job and it makes financial sense, but I've spent 8 years building a life here for me and my children. I can't stop crying and really don't want the kids to pick up on how upset I am. They're 5 and 3. How can I adjust to the prospect of moving?
Oh, miserable and mood on. That's hard. It really is. And it sounds like you've worked really hard in creating a happy life here. So I think that's one of the things to keep in mind, is that you are going through a period of intense transition, but also grief and loss in contemplating leaving behind a life that you've really come to know and enjoy. So in that respect, I think it's important to be kind to yourself and give yourself some space and grace to process that. And also looking for resources. There's a lot of great resources that you can reach out to, including books, to help you understand what you're going through. And one of the simplest is the Kubler-Ross grief cycle, where it talks about when people experience loss. Now, when Kubler-Ross did it, it was in relationship to people facing a terminal illness, but the model is so useful in practical purposes that people can use this model when their relationship is breaking up, when people are experiencing the loss of a friendship, of someone they know, or certainly leaving a place that they love behind. And it outlines the different stages, such as depression or sadness, anger, resentment. And so sometimes just knowing what that grief process is like can be incredibly helpful in understanding what you're going through. Because one thing that's also important, it's not a linear process. So once you pass through the sadness phase, it isn't as though you're not
going to feel sad again.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you can identify and I'm feeling really sad right now. And so it might be being gentle to yourself on those days and taking on what you can manage without overloading yourself. Or it might be reaching out to a friend or looking at pictures or even just taking the time to write about what you're leaving behind and processing that. So in that respect, it's, important to sort of understand what you're going through so you don't feel blindsided by some of the intense emotions that can accompany this. Mm-hmm. Being kind to yourself, reaching out for support if you find that it's difficult making that transition, that it's impeding your ability to function in terms of, helping you care for your children, or if it's affecting your relationship with your husband, reach out for help before it becomes a problem. And this is one thing, as we're talking about therapy, oftentimes when people come in to see people like me or my colleagues, they've let it sort of deteriorate to a certain point. And so sometimes just checking in with a professional and having a session or two on how do I navigate this change, how do I navigate this life transition, can give you the tools that you need to set you off on the right foot. Mm-hmm. So you don't feel lost and floundering during this time of transition.
Would it be useful for a couple to go together if they're planning to leave the UAE, or to discuss, changes in dynamics, changes in circumstances, making sure there's not any resentment or underlying, issues there? Is that something you've seen?
Sure. Well, I think it's, oftentimes therapy is just meeting people where they're at. And if a couple can come in and discuss, that's, a great situation to be in. If only one can come in, we can work with that as well. So it's wherever you're at, the therapist will meet you there.
Joseph messaging saying, lots of people complain about the cost of therapy. I can't afford not to go. It's helped me tackle my issues and enabled me to get to grips with financials and stuff that saved me more than the cost of therapy. Thank you for that, Joseph. Now, Chastity, we've said, and I'm speaking as a British person who has a very British husband, that it seems a bit of an other concept. And you're here as an American talking about therapy, and I still find it...
sounds very American, doesn't it?
It does sound very American. It does, for sure. And obviously, we've referenced the cost, and that can be prohibitive for a lot of people. It is on insurance in some situations as well, so don't think that that's not worth exploring, because it absolutely is. It might be paying claim, but you may well be able to get that back. Mm-hmm. What are, aside from cost and, you know, the kind of practical side of that, what do you think would stop someone who needs mental health support or some guidance, an impartial ear, what do you think could be stopping people from reaching out?
I love that question. I think the first is not realizing that they can be helped, that help is out there. And so part of that is just thinking that this is how it is. I stiff upper lip. I just need to muddle my way through this.
It's going to get, if I ignore it, it'll get better.
If I ignore it, if I drink my way through, distract myself with, throw myself. And I think that's a key part, is that sometimes people just don't know that help is available. People oftentimes don't realize how bad it may have gotten. And so particularly with a number of disorders, what leads people into therapy is often a friend that says, you know, I haven't seen you in a while. You know, you've been calling in sick to work. Things aren't getting done at home. I'm really worried about you. And so oftentimes people don't have insight into just how much their lives have been impacted by whatever psychological struggle is going on. Mm-hmm. So I think part of that is just pure insight into their problem. And we know with things like depression, anxiety, it's often slippery slope where the world becomes progressively, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. And before they know it, they're not going out and engaging in any of the activities they once did, but they don't know how they got there. Mm-hmm. So I think those are two of the main reasons why people don't seek therapy. Sometimes it is just an issue of not knowing where to start. Who do I go to?
Would you say GP can be a good first word of mouth? What's the best route, do you find?
It's, I think in the States, interestingly enough, it's GPs that are primarily responsible for writing prescriptions of antidepressants.
Oh, really?
So they are the first point of contact, oftentimes, for people that are struggling. And they'll go in, they'll say, well, I've been having, you know, tummy aches, I've been difficulty sleeping, I just can't seem to focus at work. And you know, thankfully, there's a number of really astute GPs that say, well, we've done all the tests. There is no organic basis for what you're going through right now. It sounds like it might be psychological. And they'll get the referral to the psychologist. They may also get a prescription. And we know that from research, going from that GP to the psychologist, maybe 50% actually follow through with seeing the psychologist. Okay. So when looking at why that is, part of it is making the call. They've never done a medical model. They're comfortable with a doctor's clinic. But sitting, and I shouldn't say sitting in the therapy room or sitting in the clinic waiting room, but envisioning themselves sitting in that waiting room is something that is, and it's the unknown.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is. Where do you think self-worth could come into the equation about perhaps not feeling like you're important enough, or you're not a priority? You're happy to get, you know, pay for your kid to have, you know, X amount, 1,000 dirhams worth of orthodontics done, or, you know, make sure everybody else is taken care of.
Or having that 21 dirham coffee.
Yeah.
How many times a week?
Yeah. Exactly. But I think many people, it could be, it's not important enough for me to go. This isn't a priority for our family. Sure. And we always come back to happy parents, happy kids, happy wife, happy life. But I think that's a barrier that I've known a lot of people go through, thinking it's for other people. As you said, it can't help me. And do you know what? I'll be fine.
Sure.
We just need to shake it off. It's just a phase.
And it's, I think what you're capturing actually really beautifully is this situational component. It's like, I really need, you know, they're driving in the car and they're like, you know, I just can't deal with this. I really need some help. It's not as bad as I thought it was. I can make it through. I can do this. And there's nothing wrong with that improvements. But if, again, you're seeing that world getting smaller, that fully becoming more and more limited, then, you know, you're not making it through it.
And it could be time to reach out.
Yes.
I'm Helen Farmer. Loads of texts coming in for our expert this afternoon. Chastity O'Connell joins us in studio for On the Couch, offering some emotional support. Thank you. We'll be talking about therapy this afternoon and really trying to demystify it. Lots of people have got a lot to say on this. Carly got in touch saying, if you have a good therapist that you trust, the therapy will only work if you, the patient, does the work the therapy suggests. It's not the duty of the therapist to fix others' problems. A weekly hour session is not going to change your life around. Therapy is where you get guidance, but it takes the patient implementing the tools in their everyday life. And that's where the transformation really starts to take place. I've battled with depression and I've seen a few therapists and finally found one that works for me. That's really good to hear, Carly. And a message here saying, no name on this one, marriage counselling works. My wife and I were having huge problems relating to communicating properly or not at all, to be honest, but we've started seeing a counselling together. You both have to want to make it work, which I think actually points to a really interesting idea there that, you know, you might want to drag your other half along for marriage counselling, but do you both need to be emotionally invested?
Well, here's, I love that this came up, and I want a special shout out to Carly. Thank you. Because it is important to understand that it is 1 hour a week, and there's a lot that goes on in that hour, but at the same time, part of the therapist's role is to help engage the client in exploring and making these subtle shifts. So thanks, Carly.
I don't want to liken it to physiotherapy, but when I go and see a physiotherapist, they go, I'm going to email you the exercise I've used at home. And you go, oh, I don't want to do the exercises at home. I just want you to fix me,
yes,
please.
Yes.
If only it was that easy.
If only. But when we're talking about marriage counseling, one of the things that I think is so important is that it is not uncommon that when a couple comes for marriage counseling and one of them really wants to be there and the other one is disengaged, that disengaged partner may be suffering from a psychological disorder, his or herself. Okay. And so in that situation, it's important that they get the treatment that they need. And so what may look like disengagement, lack of interest, not wanting to go, or resistance in coming to therapy, might actually, when you start digging and understanding what's going on, might look like an underlying depression or anxiety, which can definitely have a big impact on the quality of the marriage. So it's important to get that treated first.
Good insight there. A question here, no name on this one. I think we can squeeze it in before 2 o'clock. Asking, my wife is 43 and a full-time mum. We have an only child who is 9. Sometimes other mummy friends are there and it's all very jolly and fun. But in my opinion, it is too regular, 2 or 3 times a week. And then she falls asleep around 9 o'clock. I find it all a bit sad. And whenever I bring it up, I'm accused of being a bore. Any insights there, Chastity?
So there's so many great topics that are coming up that
I'm
really loving.
We haven't got enough time to cover it all.
So what I'll say is what's interesting is when we're talking about this situation, is that oftentimes people don't have a firm idea of what problematic drinking may entail or how is that defined. And when there's a certain level of regularity and it's impeding engagement in other activities, and if it's not able to be substituted with tea, coffee, cake, or other activities, then and the regularity of it. So you're looking at a picture of this behavior occurring in context and trying to understand what's going on. Are we talking about loneliness? Are we talking about alcohol being used to bring people together and to help you know, reduce inhibition so people can feel more connected. You know, in an expat environment like Dubai, you have people coming together and it can feel incredibly awkward meeting mm-hmm. people for the first time, but we're all feeling awkward together. And some people, again, when we're talking about emotional reactivity, are more sensitive to those feelings. So are we looking at some underlying, is the drinking being used to facilitate communication and comfort, or is it something that, well, it could be coffee, it could be tea, you know, really trying to understand what's going on, and also falling asleep early, what's happening? Are children, you know, getting put to bed, or is there opportunity for engagement, or is it just lights out and there's no prospect of interaction? And so we're trying to understand, is this problematic? And it's right to, you know, it's fair enough to be concerned about regularity, particularly if you see it increasing. Mm-hmm. And so what I would, it sounds like you've tried to talk to her about it and being accused of being a bore.
So she's on the defensive.
It sounds like it's a sensitive subject. Yeah. And so I don't know how the subject is coming up, but it's a question of, you know, what draws you guys together? Is there, you know, somewhere else you might like to meet, you know, rather than being in the house and drinking? And if that, again, evokes a kind of defensiveness, then we might be talking about something that, you know, could use some support from a professional.
Okay. Chastity O'Connell, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Really, really appreciate your insights, and I'm grateful that you are able to shine a light on therapy and hopefully allowing people a bit more confidence and understanding of how they can be helped. It's not as scary as you might think. It's not as other as you might think, and you may well benefit greatly. Chastity, yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.